let me finish this. We were doing this wonderful Thompson collage where, so are you there, Bert?
Yes.
Bert's
yes,
here. Yeah, Bert's here. Okay, so we would go reviewing him talking about the angel and how he's saying this is a new angel. The angel of Lindisfarne, it should be the angel of Dobstown, but he's calling it the angel of Lindisfarne, and it's released from the chapel, so he's claiming credit for this, and this is a new kind of angel. So in attempt to describe it, he says, it's a cord of oscillating light, blue, magenta, and indigo, more vivid than their earthly shades, held in a turning stellar cloud of two asymmetrical wings, of course, ions owns the word cloud, that producing a slight wobble of a colored blue pulsation belongs to a field of stars. So the stellar cloud belongs to, the wobble belongs to, or the cloud belongs to the field of stars. And he says, this is no mere angel of place, no spirit of mountain or stream, or spirit of mental gathering of men, or mental gathering itself, or an earthly zeitgeist of an age of sudden art and heart's revolt against hoarded gold and oiled wars. But as she tells me, he claims that she's communicating to him, this, she's the scryed star I sensed when I sighted the tower to the rise of the Pleiades. When I sighted the tower, he lined it up to the rise of the Pleiades. Then he said, this angel is something, no, the angel is a prefiguring of something larger. Something larger is just about to erupt into human time. Now, Bert, that's not the way to describe it. This thing is going to erase human time, not erupt into human time. Right, Bert?
Yes. That's it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Something larger is just about to erupt into human time, a rearrangement of the earth and time, we would add, an addition of a second sky, an emergent evolution of another subtle body through a great collective death, caught and molded in an archangel's imagining of concerted time. So Ion's imagining of time, of this context, 2009, that's an accurate description of Ion entering time on March 18, 2009. And he imagined a time and concertedly molded it for a couple of years, right? Through the revelations and the rewrite.
Yes.
He was moving time along. A false time, a fabricated time. I forget what's the premise of time, the false premise of time. There's something we did with the box, the little box, and he called it playing with time or something. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yes.
Making time tell or something. There's a clip that you give on that about time.
Right.
Yeah, stretching time.
So,
stretching time.
Right. So he caught, and Thompson says, caught and molded, this collective death is caught and molded in an archangel's imagining of concerted time. It has to be imagined because it's not real or it's not solid. So then he continues in the next poem about his, again, the angel, it's called The Angel in My Cabin. So more attempts to describe this timeless, beyond time, but entering time phenomenon. He goes, look, this is not literary. Not a trope recalling Rilke, a famous early 20th century poet. So it's not a metaphor out of poetry. Look, this is not literary. Not a trope recalling Rilke. His angel, Rilke's angels were Islamic, sounds in the wind like the call to prayer. This angel is no Jungian archetype, no dreamed projection. I see it in the waking mind as soon as I begin to sit. Samadhi is not required, like a remote aimed at my eye by the angel in hyperspace. My third eye opens instantly, and I see the vivid colors. Blue, gold, indigo, magenta. As we see a painting on the wall, righted in the third dimension, it means put in that limited perspective, so the angel sees me while she is in the fourth and fifth dimension, the word isn't there, around me in Indra's jeweled net of light, a blue plasma of neuron stones connecting light, a fractal scape of what the universe looks like in pictures I've seen in Nature magazine. So you see, there's your fragments of the previous poem, the neuron, the fractal. You get that, Bert? You know, he's echoing.
Yeah.
Developing. And he goes, I tell you, this is for real. Sounds like an Ionette. I tell you, this is for real. At first, I saw a pulsing star. The next time, I was inside it. I learned the star was yin, not yang, that I should feel it as female, a new intimate life partner, like a shakti, wife or lover, back into sex, a principality of groups, an incarnation versed in sex. He demands his angel to be versed in sex. A new intimate life partner, like a shakti, wife or lover, a principality of groups, and incarnation versed in sex. To prove her point, she came in dreams as a naked Angelina Jolie, punning at Sigmund Freud's Wit and the Unconscious's Urtext. That's one of Freud's main famous books and early writings, Wit and the Unconscious. So to prove her point, she came in Bill's dreams as a naked Angelina Jolie, punning at Sigmund Freud's Wit and the Unconscious's Urtext, Ur means original, that Wit, punning that Wit and his pretty angel, in quotes, pretty angel, were having fun alone in night. The next night she appeared attired in a red satin costly gown for my talk at a book party in an old house in Santa Fe. I had expected to float up out of the body, then escape the astral plane to meet Das Ich, which comes from Hegel, I think. The higher self of Steiner's schemes, Rudolf Steiner. But this threw the roadmap away and changed the order of the night. He fucked up again. I had expected to float up out of the body, then escape the astral plane to meet Das Ich, the higher self of Steiner's schemes, but this threw the roadmap away. If that's a good ending. So then the next thing, that was the angel in my cabin. Now the next poem, in my cabin, the last night in Crestone. So he's continuing this encounter with the angel in Crestone. And I don't know, I know he left Crestone around 1983. He stopped living there, I think, early 80s. So maybe that's what he's referring to. So he says, embodied in God, the seraphim fold and unfold double sets of mudrid wings. Their entwined trunks are a sublime forest of gesturing wings in the soft light of dawn. I did not know yet that that light was God, allowed by the seraphim, dissolving into the fullness of unfathered light, wordless with cleared mind, I sink back again to the earth. He fucked up again. I sink back again to earth. The voice of David appearing beside me at the subtle edge of earth, standing in for the old role of Diamond, like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. We jump down into the Niagara Falls of the human stream. See, jumps back into humanity. I visit old homes, refine my body in yoga nidra, closing the book on the night's still travels. There's the title of the book right there on page 86. In poem number 19, and we know 19 is Bob's name, Bob's number. So he says, closing the book on the night's still travels. Then he talks about Richard Soshi somebody, what's his name? A friend of his who bought out Crestone for Zen Roshi something. He runs the Zen Center in San Francisco, and they took over some of the Crestone Lindisfarne buildings or something. Richard something Baker, who later, Thompson years later, writes a big expose of and puts him down. And this poem may refer to that later realization. Yeah, his name is Richard Baker. And he has a Soshi or something added to it. So the poem number 20 is To Zentatsu, that's a name for Richard Baker, To Zentatsu on Leaving Crestone. So he tells Mr. Richard Baker, sit if you must, but then let's face it, sumo wrestlers too push talented fat on Japanese mats. Achieving Zen mind is your skill, just like wrestling or singing in absolute pitch. Enlightenment's not how you go sitting into Buddha mind, but how you come out, unrobed among us. So it seems like he's putting down Richard Baker's priestly robes, Zen robes that he wears as head of the Zen Center. So he's saying, yeah, you can achieve Zen mind and you go merge into the Buddha mind. Ah, that's not the point. You are to come out in an unrobe among us. Who's us? Eindam, the little man, different implications there. So he's saying, okay, you can meditate. Sit if you must. But then let's face it, sumo wrestlers too push talented fat on Japanese mats. Achieving Zen mind is your skill, just like wrestling or singing in an absolute pitch. Enlightenment's not how you go sitting into Buddha mind, but how you come out, unrobed among us. So, now he uses the pulsar star as a reference point a lot. So in the next poem, to Alilia in Portland, look up Bernini's take on St. Teresa's erotic look, set out of all places in Vatican City. That's like 500 years ago. Sex there is metaphor for auras angelically engaged. Alfred North Whitehead, he says. Whitehead's concrescence, not sucked into fact, but two apart as interpenetrating. Internal blue neuronal, there's your neuron, neuronal fire. My closed eyes see that cobalt color in vortices. The same ecstatic arrival when you come into a Sufi success of flesh in heart's fire. I sense your ambivalence at loose in your young body, as my older one remembers nights and transient acts. Eurida, your blue eyes suggest. But I need to close my own to see, because his new angelic sex, so he's proclaiming a new sex, as old as creation, keeps us apart, and me captured by a pulsar star. So this whole section ends. And this is the three cycles of poems. One's dedicated to his wife, Beatrice. The next one that we're ending is dedicated to his son, Evan. Then the third one's dedicated to his daughter, Hillary. So he ends this whole thing we've been doing with the word envoy, sort of like a message and a P.S. Envoy, the art of the fugue. Now, after all the instants, I alone with Bach's hocked copper plates, retracing life in sleepless nights, past the time others fall to sleep, unshriven in their desires, weaving the shroud of their bodies in generation of straught lives, would not be born again of dreams, but would sound a soul in music, aloft in bliss, just under light, at the edge of perfected God, for I am not in any parts partial to Zen enlightenment, since I am from and won't forsake soft, volvid love, an ecstatic yes, alive in the age of stars. So he ends the thing saying, I will not give up sex. He will not forsake the soft, volvid love, an ecstatic yes, alive in the age of celebrities. So I'm going to read the last two poems and I'll flow into them. So to Alilia, whoever that is, probably some adulterous affair, to Alilia in Portland. He's telling her or him, look up Bernini, a famous sculptor, the all-purpose Renaissance guy. Look up Bernini's take on St. Teresa's erotic look. She was a famous saint, you know, in an erotic, in sort of a passion as the arrow of something pierced her heart. Famous painting. Look up Bernini's take on St. Teresa's erotic look set out of all places, set in Vatican City, set out of all places in Vatican City. Sex there is metaphor for auras angelically engaged. Whitehead's concrescence, not sucked into fact, but two apart is interpenetrating, internal blue neuronal fire. My closed eyes see that cobalt color in vortices, the same ecstatic arrival when you come into a Sufi success of flesh and heart's fire. I sense your ambivalence at loose in your young body as my older one remembers nights and transient acts. Eurida, your blue eyes suggest. But I need to close my own to see, because this new angelic sex, as old as creation, keeps us apart, and me captured by a pulsar star. Then he goes over to the P.S. Now, after all the instants, I alone with Bach's hocked copper plates, retracing life in sleepless nights, past the time others fall to sleep, unshriven in their desires, weaving the shroud of their bodies in generation of straught lives, all that would not be born again of dreams, but would sound a soul in music. Aloft, there he is, floating in bliss, aloft in bliss, just under light at the edge of perfective God, not a perfected God, just at the edge of it, for I am not in any parts partial to Zen enlightenment, since I am from and won't forsake soft, volvid love, and ecstatic yes, alive in the age of stars. So I hope it hasn't been too much of a mambling, bumbling, hard-to-follow stuff. I've repeated enough lines for you to get it, right, Bert?
Yes. I agree with Chad. Chad said earlier that it's like Ulysses. Because in Ulysses, what was it? The main theme was someone taking a dump. And if you look at what all of you read, well, all that I've heard, there's always little subtle references to sex. So it's sort of a Thompson study and Joyce. And, you know, he can't compete with Finnegan's Wake, so he kind of does a Ulysses with his strings it with his Buddhist, Zen, you know, all those different mystical things, and then he ties it, links it all with sex. Seems to me from just listening.
Yeah, yeah. And sex is time, and he thinks there's time, so he thinks he has to have sex.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me just check. What's he saying? What do you think? You know, I get all these prostitutes, endless prostitutes, wanting to be my friend on Facebook. All they have is you go to their Facebook, it's just a picture of them being pretty and half naked. That's all they offer. They have no ideas, no fucking zen, no fucking awareness of LaRouche or McLuhan. They have nothing to offer.
Stop! Whoa! Is something's wrong here? Am I losing my brain? No. We're good. Yeah.
They're all burgers trying to drag me down.
Some little bimbo that wants to go out and, you know, kind of spread her legs and get it on.
She wants to get paid. She wants to be escorted and then get paid. They're all in it for the money.
Oh, I'm cool with that. I've got about it. Oh, man, I think I'm, like, into about, like, 1,200 wives or something at this point. Man, it's crazy.
Who? You have 1,200 wives? Is that what you're saying?
I'm more confused. Yes.
Where are you? Okay, there you are. Okay, look, we got some stuff to do. Okay, Chad, you're there? Let me, I got to check this.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good, because we want to do the Sydney's Wake thing. But I'll just tell you, I have someone requesting, and this is wonderful. This is not a prostitute. It's somebody named Jeannie Marshall, who's actually the personal development coach and mentor at Marshall House at the American University in Washington, D.C. Also, she's in Santa Monica, California, and she has 329 groups, and she is interested in knowing me. So I will confirm the request. Right? That's done. Okay, so now we got... is Roxy here? Do I have to bring Roxy in myself? Is Roxy here? Roxy has... I think she can stay up all night because she's got the day... got 3 days off. So we want to do something on that level, but we want to do Chad first. And maybe Chad can be part of the Zappa. We actually have done stuff on Zappa. Chad, are you limited by your sleep and stuff? You going to go to sleep or something?
I don't know. I'll just play it by ear.
Okay. So let's go into weather. Finnegan's Wake is the climactic communication from the Atlantic. No, the Atlantean Gaian dynamical system. So is... you have, Thompson has three phases. Some new earth comes in that expresses what's coming, and it's a little ahead of its time. Oh, man, we got to shut that guy down. What the fuck is that? How come I muted the wrong part? Now he's muted. We won't be hearing from fucking Corbin for a while. Long muted. Okay. So there's the formative phase, and then there's the dominant phase where the art and novels and music has a certain style, and it was prefigured by the formative phase. And then the dominant phase is happening, and it's successful, and mortgage is paid, and success is guaranteed. And then a new environment sneaking up. And so during the third phase of a mentality or an environment called the climactic, it is sort of completing the best of what has been unfolding in the formative and dominant, but it will prefigure the next phase a little bit. So Thompson says that Finnegan's Wake ends the industrial phase and is prefiguring the android meme biospheric phase. And the question is it really connected to the industrial Atlantic mentality, and maybe not, and more connected to the either the fourth phase, the Pacific biospheric, or the fifth ion phase? So, Chad, you don't have the book there. I could go get the dominant. I don't know how much.
I just have the charts that I have the charts that you put on Facebook by looking at the Facebook images.
Yeah, and he's got the climactic. The climactic. What is the
climactic literary climactic literary masterpiece. First is Gilgamesh epic. Second is Dante's Divine Comedy. Third is Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. Fourth is Question Mark.
Yeah, no, they represent different phases. So the first one is Gilgamesh. That's the climactic mathematical cosmology of the riverine or ancient civilization.
Right. Oh, okay, so you want to know the cultural ecology. So the one corresponds to riverine. The second, Dante's Divine Comedy, is the Mediterranean ecology.
Geometrical. That's the geometrical mentality. Yeah, it won't show it in. You have to have all the charts, which are on my Facebook. But there's a earlier four phases and then a later five phases. So I know what they are. So basically, Dante completes the geometric phase and the algebraic mentality. That's before the industrial, what he calls Galilean dynamics. There's much movement once you get into 1500, 1600, moving around the world, the moving of money through time, creating interest, and movement of ballistics and movement of everything. So that's the Galilean dynamical thing. And he's saying the climactic expression of that period is Finnegan's Wake. Now you have the Pacific post-Atlantean reality, post-industrial mentality. You now have the chaos mentality of the android meme or the electronic vortex or information highway, this wonderful world we're in right now. What would be the formative? It's the dominant would be the dominant and the climactic are not predicted. He just has a question mark there. That's like too far along the way if you use his time span. So we're asking if Finnegan's Wake anticipates the fourth chaotic dynamical system, and it should not be a ending of the Galilean industrial phase. So here's my solution, Chad. What he should have there for the climactic literary masterpiece for the Galilean 1500 to, say, 1900 phase is Ulysses by James Joyce. That's a novel. He outdoes every other novel, and that's that. But Finnegan's Wake is not a book. It's not a literary masterpiece. It's a radio program in the beginning, as McLuhan said. Finnegan's Wake is way much involved with our time than with ending the book phase. You get that, Chad?
Yeah, so are you saying that Finnegan's Wake goes into the third phase where Joyce
no.
Finnegan's Wake is? Sorry, Ulysses goes into the third phase where Finnegan's
yes.
Wake is.
That's right.
And then Finnegan's
and then
Wake shouldn't even be in there because it's not a book.
Right, it should be in the fourth phase. The Pacific, he calls it Pacific Aerospace. Earlier in 1985, then he makes it Pacific Biospheric. Sometimes he just calls it Biospheric. It's basically the global membrane that we're all living in. And then I would add to that, I add the later development of the Android meme called the mythic erogenous zone. This is what Thompson's sex thing can be maybe Croker. And he's trying to figure out what sex is, but he doesn't get the discarnate sex enough. And then after that comes the Dobbstown, which has the millennial ecstatic, so it's not limited to sex, millennial ecstatic of five-bodied expression. And you can fit Finney's Wake into the five-bodied, the millennial ecstatics of five-bodied expression. You can have Finney's Wake. So that's way beyond what Thompson's saying. And then you have Ion being the hex attic, not even on the chart. But we want to say that Finnegan's Wake anticipates the Ionic phase. So the sixth phase, or if you're looking at the four levels there, you're looking at the older one, Ion is the fifth phase. But if you use the five phases that Thompson uses later, then Ion is the sixth phase. So the question is my chart the last climactic literary masterpiece of the chaos phase that started off by Finnegan's Wake? So, you want to retranslate that? for the people, Chad, or just repeat it, depending how clear it was?
I thought that was pretty well stated. I'd only be repeating what you said. Is your chart, okay. Is the Tiny Note chart, the climactic literary masterpiece of the fourth phase that Thompson outlines in his fourfold patterns here?
Right. So we understand why Ulysses is the end of the third phase, and we're trying to figure out what would make up the fourth phase, which can become the fifth phase when you have the expanded chart, because you're looking at the earlier chart. So the beginning of the Dobbstown phase is Finnegan's Wake. The dominant medium could be Finnegan's Wake, and then the climactic is the chart. But let's make the dominant, the middle part of this present phase, before Ion, that would be McLuhan. McLuhan's masterpiece. See, you can't be a glorious, wonderfully written novel. Thomas Pynchon redoes that. He's a tremendous writer in the old-fashioned way of making amazing descriptions and total surround, multi-sensory involvement of great dexterity with written language. That's done by Joyce and Ulysses. So novelists are at best trying to catch up to Finnegan's Wake. So a real artist of this present phase of the Android meme would someone who'd write books, but they wouldn't be have characters and people as content. It would have the content of media, the 27 media, I think it is, in Finnegan's Wake. No, 26 media. In Marshall McLuhan's Understanding Media, they are characters. So McLuhan made a new kind of novel that wasn't recognized. So let's make McLuhan the dominant form, and my chart completes Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan and points to Ion. Now, the reason, my chart is not fucking great literature. It's a skimpy little skeleton, but because of its implications of what it's going to manufacture, as laid out in that last paragraph by Thompson on page 188 of his Transforming History book, that great collage of factors, which are all in my chart. The chart, what we need in our time is not a book. Nobody has time to read it. We haven't got time for any kind of literary mathematical masterpiece. You have to have something instant that communicates the whole thing rapidly and is also a puzzle so that you have many after image of time spending looking at the chart and listening to someone talk about it. But it has to communicate instantly. There's no time for something. So that's why it's a more appropriate art piece for our time. All right? Have I explained that to everybody's satisfaction? Or do we
yes.
take questions about it?
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, can you imagine, Time Magazine, they named the best of the whole 20th century. So they named Ulysses as the top novel of the 20th century. If they had a category, which actually they did have a category, which I won. There is the fraud of the century was won by J.R. Bob Dobbs. The
beat out Geraldo Rivera.
Right. And many other people. And it was this cartoon image based on my father, and apparently a lot of sub-geniuses clicked and clicked and clicked. You know, a lot of them had the time to run up the votes. But it doesn't matter. People working for Bob, they're going to make sure Bob wins, and Bob won it in a strange category. We have to look at fraud of the century. Well, that's McLuhan's, you think my fallacy is wrong. You have to be a fallacy. Communicating with analog media is inappropriate, fallacious, and nowhere near what actually is happening. Proven by the fact that when the Android meme flipped into Ion, nobody even yet has a full grasp of Ion. So, what was my first part of the sentence there? The fallacy, the fraud, you have to be a fraud to be even a candidate for the last position in Thompson's chart there. So I fulfill all those requirements, and even though it's just a flimsy, so I'm saying, can you imagine Time Magazine sitting around looking at this piece of paper with, it has 322 notations on it, my tiny note chart. And they're looking at this flimsy thing. It's not even like a painting. It's not a musical piece. It's got none of the traditional art aesthetics in it. And they're listening to me say, this is the greatest art piece ever. This is the greatest periodic table. And I don't think they would believe me back in 2000. The chart was made in 95. I could have submitted it if anybody knew about it, if I gave a damn. So it it made the... It got acknowledged indirectly through the fraudulent award. But here we are today, 16 years later, and it's obvious to the initiated that Bob's chart is where it's at. Now, Chad, you posted this thing and nominated the chart. It hadn't even occurred to me that it was the greatest fucking art form of our time. I never thought of it that way. And so Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Bob.
Because you nominated me, and I won, it's like it's been built 3 days that this has unfolded, I had to quickly come up with an explanation of why I was the proper recipient, which you've just heard. I just made a bunch of shit up to explain why I was the appropriate recipient of that, because it's like the famous Franz Kafka story where Abraham gets picked by God, and he's dumbfounded. What? Who, me? What do I do? What? I got to kill my kid. I got to do this. I can do that. It's a great parable or story that Franz Kafka writes out. It's a book called Parables and Paradoxes, and I always remembered it. And Abraham is going to his assigned task, and he say, "Why me? What did I do?" Well, that's like me. He's anticipating me. I'm here. Chad points out, "Well, Bob, your tiny note chart could be the fucking climactic masterpiece." I go, "What? You're fucking nuts, Chad." But then I had time to think about it. I said, "Well, Jesus, hell, well, this is a pretty impressive chart." And I started to remember what I'd done, because I always forget what I did, right? I didn't remember that I had a chart.
Then you had to hurry up and write your acceptance speech on the napkin.
Yeah, that's what I did. I had to make. I didn't even write it. I did it right now, and I made it up. And I lived a little bit ahead of myself, so I kept coming up with stuff that sounded consistent. But it was so new to me, I wasn't sure if I communicated it well. So how's that? That is a tremendous. You mentioned me. That's a great. I got to play that. If I ever win a fucking Oscar, I'm going to play that. What I just said, I'm going to play that. That's my acceptance speech. Okay. Awesome.
Well, it's perfect because in that section, if you put the tiny note chart in the fourth position, and then you said the fifth position, which isn't on here, would be Ion. Well, yeah. The tiny note chart really helped evoke Ion.
Yes,
yeah.
That's the huge. We're not trying to be a good book. Who gives a fuck about a book? We got enough of them. We need. It should be climactic, new environment created.
For antenna. It was a climactic antenna.
Yes, but it's environmental. It's a changed earth, like we just read in the Thompson poem. It's a second sky. You must have a. I announced lockdown Bob rule was a changed earth. A changed Akasha, a changed sky, everything is included in that. All scrapped. And then if you try to picture it, it's just a flat line. Remember, the bigger chart is the Dobbs formula chart. Always, you know, we're enhancing that chart. And that ends with mass die-off, a flat line. The final ninth level at the bottom is a sign of the, you know, the life system thing going beep.
Or it's just a sine wave. Yeah.
No, it's not a sine wave. There's no life. There's nothing there. Have you ever looked at that chart, Chad?
The dashes, yeah. It's just got the dashes under the ALP.
It's a flat line.
Yeah.
It's a dramatic point in all the TV shows. They're all trying to keep somebody alive, and then all of a sudden, uh-oh, and there it is. That's what I was trying to show, the flat line of everything human. As we moved into a new ion-dominated principality. And there's all kinds of phrases that I can find in Thompson's poetry that helps to describe what I just said about the flatline condition. So, let's see, did I finish the time thing? So I was going through all the time dates, so I think I'd like to just go back and finish that. That listing. Cause so I did 65, 69. I might have covered a lot of it in what I read. 69, we did that. 76, 77, we did all that. Up to 83. Oh, what's that? Someone's clicking off. Everybody still here?
Yeah.
And then in the third part, which I haven't finished yet. I want to read this, Chad. So who disconnected? Did we lose an important mind?
I'm here.
Is that you clicking stuff?
Nope. I go on mute when I'm not talking.
Okay, so what is that clicking? That's not you, Bart. Bert?
No. No.
So it's somebody in maybe... Okay, so I want to read you this section that he quotes from a writer called Diodorus of Siculus. So somebody way back there in Greece or someplace, you know, 2,000 years ago, Diodorus of Siculus, and it's part of the Harvard University Press, Loeb Classical Library. The book came out in 1935, and it's about a figure called Abaris, A-B-A-R-I-S. It says, asterisk at the bottom, this is on page 94 of the Still Travels poetry book of Thompson. Abaris is apparently a purely mythical figure who in some authors sailed on his arrow as on a witch's broomstick through the air over rivers and trees. So I mentioned that this guy, he wanted to meet Pythagoras. So he sailed on an arrow. So listen to this. So there's this section of the book. And it says, and there's also on the island both a magnificent, oh, I should say this, the Dobbs Quadrant, the Shakespearean character or play that's referred to is Henry V and The Tempest. And The Tempest is Prospero on an island with Ariel and other phenomena. Have you ever seen the movie? Anyways, so you have this mythical paradisical island. Like Maui is the Dobbs Quadrant. So with the island factor in mind, listen to this section that Thompson quotes. And there is also on the island both a magnificent sacred precinct of Apollo and a notable temple, which is adorned with many votive offerings and is spherical in shape. Furthermore, a city is there which is sacred to this god, Apollo, and the majority of its inhabitants are players on the cithara. And these continually play on this instrument in the temple and sing hymns of praise to the god, glorifying his deeds. Next paragraph. The Hyperboreans also have a language, we are informed, which is peculiar to them and are most friendly disposed towards the Greeks. So the Hyperboreans like the Greeks. And especially towards the Athenians and the Devonians. Oh! Delians. Close! The Delians. D-E-L-I-A-N-S. But almost Devonians. So anyways, the Hyperboreans are especially friendly towards the Athenians and the Delians, who have inherited this goodwill from most ancient times. The myth also relates that certain Greeks visited the Hyperboreans and left behind them their costly votive offerings bearing inscriptions in Greek letters. And in the same way, Abaris, who we were just reading, apparently a purely mythical figure, he apparently is a Hyperborean. He came to Greece in ancient times and renewed the goodwill and kinship of his people, the Delians. Then they say this. They also say that the moon, as viewed from this island, appears to be but a little distance from the earth and to have upon it prominences. Remember how I am saying the moon's coming closer to us? So, reading that sentence again. They also say that the moon, as viewed from this island, the Hyperboreans island, appears to be but a little distance from the earth and to have upon it prominences like those of the earth, which are visible to the eye. The account is also given that the god visits the island every 19 years. There's the Bob number. The period in which the return of the stars to the same place in the heavens is accomplished. And for this reason, the 19-year period is called by the Greeks the year of Meton, M-E-T-O-N. That's in quotes, year of Meton. At the time of this appearance of the god, he both plays on the cithara and dances continuously the night through from the vernal equinox until the rising of the Pleiades. Sounds like payday. Expressing in this manner his delight in his successes. That's payday. And the kings of this city and the supervisors of the sacred precinct are called Boreadae. B-O-R-E-A-D-A-E. Boreadae. Since they are descendants of Boreas. And the succession to these positions is always kept in their family. There's an oligarchy. So that's, we can think of the angel chart, the chart of, you know, the images of the new Solomon's Temple that's in the angel diagram. It's implied here with this island and spherical temple and moon coming close. All right? So I read that into the record. Okay. Then I have a few pages in part three, his poem dedicated to Hillary, his daughter. But listen to this in terms of time. This one is called Manhattan Morning. It says, "Let eternity be a mark of no distinction, a point without dimension, infinite or infinitesimal, depending upon how you feel in the morning of your death." So in the morning of your death, you're going to have a certain feeling, and it will affect what you think eternity is. So let eternity be a mark of no distinction, a point without dimension, infinite or infinitesimal, depending upon how you feel in the morning of your death. Depending upon the Palisades of the Hudson, that's the Hudson River in New York, depending upon the Palisades of the Hudson, I still seem to be on not very certain ground. So he's still having a problem. I still seem to be on not very certain ground. What was ground could well be thought, or dew on grass chilled out of night, or clouds of mind providing a place to be for the moment, or whatever else it took to be dream-bodied out of night. I must have been dead, for everything was so much larger than life. New York at peace with nature in its own death, as it had never been in life. The towers of Midtown Manhattan, but just as the towers of Midtown, flooded reeds in a marsh. Remember, Matthew Rose lived on 53rd Street, and Ian said the flood that would sink the toe of Statue of Liberty would get up to about 53rd Street, which is Midtown. So the towers of Midtown flooded reeds in a marsh. The buildings listing easily to the wind that moved over the waters, obliterating all the streets. Because the ground had to have been provided by the mind, the eye could see whatever it wanted to. Do that again. Because the ground had to have been provided by the mind, that's the reason the eye could see whatever it wanted to. I, for one, could see all the way to Harper and Row, that's a book publisher, at 5th and 53rd. There's the 53rd. Its fallen windows coral to new life at the bottom of the flooded street. Once these had been my publishers in a life, I must have been... So he's talking about how, he mentions a few poems, how he's not well known anymore and books aren't published, and he has to accept the fact his time as a celebrated author is gone. So he says, "Once these had been my publishers in a life, I must have been leaving on the Palisades of the Hudson. If eternity encloses us within a smooth and perfect sphere," which would be that Hyperborean temple, "if eternity encloses us within a smooth and perfect sphere of infinitely reflected light, then time is bound to be a torus distorted sphere. Then time is bound to be a torus distorted sphere, reflecting images of conflict between demiurge and devil. Angelic torque, breaking Jacob's limbs into moments of history that lie about us like wounds of light or fallen petals of shrapnel from an exploded star. Over the curving earth I could see ascending, voyages of migration, replace peoples on the move into the newly warm waters of the North Atlantic." Now he's going to describe how everything's upside down in the earth after the polar shift. So, "over the curving earth, I could see ascending voyages of migration, replace peoples on the move into the newly warm waters of the North Atlantic. The poles must have shifted, for the set of the world seemed strangely turned around. The North Atlantic, a new southern archipelago of Faroe and Shetland Islands, Findhorn and Iona." They're islands off of the United Kingdom. But now they're like southern islands. "Volcanic Iceland and St. John's and Newfoundland, all transformed in the etheric post-glacial light into a future of Hyperborean histories, unknown and never imagined, in the era whose prehistoric monument New York had become." So, you know how New York's always been here? So, New York becomes this prehistoric about an era that's unknown and never imagined. So, New York's like an afterimage of the desired Dobbstown Iondom. I think that's how you read it. "Into a future of Hyperborean histories unknown, never imagined, in the era whose prehistoric monument New York had become." That's almost like New York becoming the formative category, Chad, right? Of the prehistoric phase, or a phase of history, the anticipator is New York.
Right.
It's the prehistoric monument. It's the formative. Okay, so two more little short poems to finish this up. So, fragment of an Icelandic Edda. You know, Eddas are the written epics of Icelandic culture. Fragment of an Icelandic Edda. Wars in heaven, worlds collide, earth breaks apart. Alien iron sinks to the core. Rings of rubble become the moon. Heat stirs, volcanoes explode. Clouds rain down into acrid seas. Froth hardens, shifting battlefield. This is what people project on the Pacific Rim volcanoes. They exaggerate that it's going to become even greater. No man of mere blood and bone dared then be. So it's going to get so eruptive, no little man or even maybe semi-ascended man is going to want to be around. What now seems settled is not. Tearing stars or tearing stars gather at the rim. Earth cracks, rocks fracture, volcanoes break, seas rise. Not a good time for men when mind wakes in rock. So if your mind wakes up embedded in rock, you, as an Ionaut, will celebrate it. But little man will say, oh, my God, I got no mind. So it's not a good time for men when mind wakes in rock. Then the final poem is about northeastern United States, Maine, I guess you say, Maine, Massachusetts. Apparently, there are rocks of old Europe underneath that part of the United States, the New England part. It's called the Norumbega Fault. So he says, I walk along the rocks of old Europe on the eastern side of the Norumbega Fault. So he's probably walking near Portland, where he lives. The Avalon terrain, this ledge inclining my soul to Ireland. Iapetus, the old ocean has gone. The Atlantic now has carried the Celts outward from Armorica, which is a word on the first page of Finney's Wake. The Atlantic now has carried the Celts outward from Armorica and Eru. Again, the Atlantic now has carried the Celts outward from Armorica and Eru here to America. That's Armorica, A-R-M-O-R-I-C-A, and Eru here to America. So it's like a combination of America and Eru. And we have Eru phones in from Norway. Bert? Is she Norwegian?
Sweden.
Okay. Sweden. So then he says, so he brings back his old yoga. In yoga nidra's lucid dream, the primordial one asked me, what are you doing? What are you doing here? And he says, I cannot, as he can, the primordial one, I cannot buckle rock, raise the sea, stir lava, or turn. Now he's got raise the sea, but the sea is a symbol of the dead, according to Ion. Stir lava or turn the wind. He goes, what am I good for that has anything to do with the true ages of Earth? So the ascended periods of Earth are the true ages. And he goes, what am I good for that has anything to do with the true ages of Earth? So he ends with this big doubt about himself, back into the fallen condition of little man. Now, our Christians among us would say, well, he's nice and humble. He's not a braggart and boaster like you, Bob. He's not Luciferian control. He's a reasonable fucking neighbor. And he's not going to brag about what he's done unless you read his book of poetry. So that point where he goes, what am I good for that has anything to do with the true ages of Earth? We come back to the beginning. And I think this was the first poem I read, the one about the ancestors where his mother says, how did you get in this family? You must be a changeling. So we come back to the fact that he's trying to figure out where he came from and he hasn't got a clue. You could say he came from God. And he doesn't want to acknowledge that. He doesn't want to acknowledge that he started himself, though there are sentences that say that. But the punchline here is nebulous, ambivalent.
Bob, that also ties into what you played a week or so ago when Ion said they don't know where Thompson comes from.
Oh, that's what I'm talking about. Oh, did you hear? You didn't hear us talk about that at the beginning?
No. No, I didn't hear that.
Oh, yes. We started many hours ago. Maybe you came in a little past it. He writes his poem on page 100. In light of what Ion says, a few days later, I read this. Now, Ion said that back in 2014, August 30th, but I'd forgotten that. So we relearned it last Saturday. A few days later, he begins this section of the poem. "How did you get in this family?" my mother asked, and then answered, "You must be a changeling. A child, the fairy switch, sneaking me out in their dark traffic below stairs in the big house where chambermaids mounted by the Lord's Randy sons were sent to neighborly estates, where milady's sickly infants, dead in childbirth, were switched at once by the wet nurse, with the young maid's infant spunked by milord's last spark. An undercover secret world where the older maids rock the boys to sleep by stroking their small cocks. All this turned by the Irish mind into a myth of the fairies from under dolmen and stone ring. The Tuatha De Danann gods reclaiming old Ireland before Malaysian and Sassenach came across Lear's green white-flowered plain." And at the end, he's going through his history of supposed Irish ancestors, mother and their parents and grandparents. So he says, this was all a big cover-up. He says, this was my covering story, complete with birth certificates, baptism records, and memories. Ireland was a metaphor for an erased pre-existence in some other fabled estate. So he's saying, I existed somewhere else before, not in Ireland. As I aged, my cover faded, and my mother began to sense I was not who I am. This is important, Bert. As I aged, my cover faded, and my mother began to sense I was not who she thought I was. Oh, that's Ryan. Like, the mother had the same question as Ian. Now, we know Ian knew this was coming and just planted the thought,
yeah,
and pretended that he didn't know. But it's pretty cool that you noticed that, and that's one of the big punchlines here. It's the wonderful Xenarchony of this week. Every Saturday we report Bob's Xenarchony, right? So I read all this after hearing it on the recording. And I didn't have to find the recording. Kim found the recording. Right? I didn't have to do nothing.
Right.
At the end of a certificate, just like I'll be doing nothing tonight, that'll prepare me for next week. You people will. Somebody out there. At the end of a certified life, I can see behind the stage set, so behind the set stage, arriving with the time I leave. At the end of a certified life, Irish pedigree is the word, I can see behind the stage set, arriving with the time I leave. So he sees himself leaving as he's arriving. All right. That's that. Now, Chad, anything you want? Did we explain? We did a good job explaining the chart. My Oscar speech was good. Prompted by...
Yeah, it was fabulous. Yeah. I'm satisfied.
Okay, well, you can hang out or go to bed. We are going to do a fantastic Zappa thing. Lots of good stuff. And I now must gather the crew. See if they're even alive. So I should best play something, right?
Sure.
Yeah, I think we need some music relief after that.
Yeah, what, we've been talking, what, like 5 hours or something?
Yeah.
Let's see. I played 3 hours music. Good news, you've only been talking for 4 hours.
Okay.
A little bit of restraint. Bob is beginning to develop moral courage and moral restraint in his mouth blather. Things are looking up.